Good morning. Welcome to Lecture 9 on the Regulation of Financial Institutions. Today's lecture will be a continuation of our discussion of troubled and insolvent banks, which we began 2 weeks ago. Before we begin the body of the lecture, let me apologize for the delay in posting this week's lecture. In fact, this is the second time I have presented this lecture. An earlier version was somehow lost on my computer. I think the machine may be getting tired as the semester wears on, as I'm sure many students are also getting tired as the semester proceeds. But it declined to take the previous lecture onto the disk, and so I had to re-record the lecture, and hopefully this time it will be more successful. So welcome to Lecture 9, and let's proceed to the substance of today's discussion. In today's lecture, we return to our discussion of troubled and insolvent banks. As you'll recall, in our last lecture, we were reviewing the basic mechanisms of supervision of all financial intermediaries, with a special emphasis on the tools used for those institutions that found themselves in financial difficulty, ranging from informal memoranda of understanding and other informal supervisory tactics, up through the more stringent cease and desist orders, civil money penalties, removal powers, and mechanisms of prompt corrective action that have developed in the United States over the past decade. At the close of the last lecture, we were beginning our discussion of disposition strategies for insolvent depository institutions, and that is what I'd like to focus our discussion on in today's class. In particular, what I want to take a look at are the various closure strategies that are employed in the United States for insolvent depository institutions, and try to compare and contrast the various approaches and discuss their benefits from a perspective of public policy. In the course of our discussion, I will introduce the concept of the least cost resolution strategy, which is an important legal concept in the United States in this area. And to the extent that there's time in today's class, there are several other issues with respect to the disposition of insolvent banks that I'd like to consider, including the special problem of dealing with legal counsel to banks that become insolvent. This is an area that's been quite controversial in the United States over the past few years, and one in which members of the class may have a special interest. Before we get into the details of today's class, I think it probably would make sense for me to justify for a moment my decision to spend this amount of time on the disposition of insolvent institutions. In the United States, this is an area of financial regulation that has received considerable attention over the years. Typically, it's an area that gets the most attention during periods of financial difficulty. Those are the periods in which the legal system is put under stress, legal doctrines develop. Oftentimes, there are statutory responses which change the scope and nature of the law, and that is certainly what has happened in the United States. There are two great periods of legal development in this area. The first in the 1930s during the Great Depression, when a number of banks in the United States failed, a large number of banks failed, and a new regulatory structure was created in the 1930s, including the introduction of federal deposit insurance to protect individuals from losses associated with bank failures, and also the creation of disposition strategies for dealing with insolvent depository institutions. This regulatory system that was developed in the 1930s stayed in place for most of this century. Actually, there were relatively small numbers of bank failures during the 1950s and 60s. The number of failures began to increase somewhat in the 1970s as economic volatility in the country increased, and then increased dramatically in the 1980s through a period of some financial difficulties. During the 1980s, there were a number of new legal developments as the number of institutions being resolved in this way increased, There were certain problems discovered in our regulatory structure, and eventually the disposition procedures were substantially reformed in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Now we have a new regulatory system in place, but we have a relatively stable economic situation in the United States, and so the number of bank failures right now is relatively small, or extremely small, actually, and the new system has not been fully tested. But it is an amalgamation of rules that have been developed over the past 65 years, and I think it offers some interesting guidance for other jurisdictions that are in the process of developing their own bank disposition strategies. And so I think it is an area that might be of interest to students in the People's Republic of China, where the issue of resolving insolvent depository institutions is presumably of considerable interest. The vehicle for discussion in today's class will be problem 5-9, which appears on page 375 to 379 of the casebook. This is a classic problem, a classic style problem in American legal education in the banking field. It involves an institution that's relatively small, less than $100 million worth of assets, that through the regular examination process, as I mentioned in the last class, finds itself in serious economic difficulty. The details are not that important, but it's sort of typical, so maybe of interest to you all. The institution has most of its assets invested in loans. Actually, this would be an unusually large amount of assets invested in loans. It suffers losses on some of the loans. 10% of the portfolio is lost. Another 20% is classified doubtful by the examiners. Usually the rule of thumb is doubtful loans will recover only 50 cents on the dollar. That is, they will lose one half of their value. So between the lost loans and the doubtful loans, the institution has 14.4, roughly $14.3 million of losses on the loan portfolio. Another 23% of the loans are classified substandard, which means they have some weakness, but they're not sufficiently troubled to warrant special provisions. This kind of an examination result would be typical of a regional bank in the United States operating in an area with economic difficulty. If there were a local recession, if a particular industry that was important in the area was in trouble, a bank might experience this kind of deterioration in its loan portfolio. Really, not the fault in all likelihood of individual bank managers, but the consequence of being in a region with a serious economic dislocation. But for whatever reason, this institution is in serious financial trouble. And if you put together the various losses plus some other deterioration in the value of securities and other assets, what you would see is that the institution has a sufficiently large loss to become insolvent. Its assets no longer are equal to its liabilities. The capital cushion of $5 million is inadequate, and so this institution is quite clearly insolvent. In fact, if you do the calculations and add up the value of the residual assets, what you see is this institution has roughly $70 million worth of assets, which is greater than its deposits, but the institution also has a $20 million Fed loan. That is a loan from the Federal Reserve System, which is, under U.S. law at least, a secured loan, which means that the loan is collateralized by some high-quality assets of the institution, presumably high-quality loans or other securities, and the Federal Reserve Board will be insured repayment of this loan. In the United States, the Federal Reserve System is what we call the lender of last resort. In fulfilling its lender of last resort functions, it often provides liquidity to banks in times of difficulty, But to provide this liquidity, it insists on collateral, which it has presumably required in this case. So as the bank found itself in difficulty, it probably requested the loan from the federal government. It received the loan, but only with collateral. And so, in effect, of the $70 million worth of assets this institution has, only $50 million are available for depositors, and that is less than the amount of deposits, $61.2 million. So, once you pull out the loan, the depositors here are clearly at risk. The problem is made slightly more complex, but I think interesting, by the fact that there are two groups of depositors in this institution: insured depositors with $49 million worth of deposits, and uninsured depositors with another $12.2 million worth of deposits. What this would mean is that most of the deposits in this institution would come from retail customers, individuals, maybe some small businesses, with deposits of less than $100,000 each. That's the extent of the insurance coverage in the United States. The federal government only insures up to $100,000 per deposit, so presumably all of the uninsured deposits are deposits in excess of that amount, which might be wealthy individuals, might be institutional investors of some sort, could be businesses with larger accounts. So there's some larger depositors and also some smaller depositors, as we'll see, that will affect the various disposition strategies available to the federal government. Now, if you read through the problem, and I would invite you to do that if you haven't done so already, this institution is about to be closed. It's being taken over by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has a variety of alternatives of how to deal with this institution. And while many aspects of these transactions, I think, are specific to the United States, these general approaches exist in other countries. There are only a variety of ways of handling an insolvent entity. And the basic choices, I think, are presented here in the context of this particular institution. The first choice, which we'll look at, is the liquidation of the institution, just shutting it down, distributing its assets as best they can be distributed to the various creditors. And then the rest of the choices have to do with what we call purchase and assumption transactions. There are a number of institutions, or at least there's one institution that's interested in purchasing the entity from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in one of two ways. And then there's a second institution, Fishkill, that also has a purchase strategy that is proposed to the government. But what I want to primarily focus on in today's discussion is the distinction between liquidation of the institution and a purchase and assumption by another financial intermediary, in this case, the Palatka National Bank. So let's start with liquidation of the institution as a strategy to consider. Now, to understand the liquidation alternative, you have to step back a moment and understand the role that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation plays in the U.S. economy, and in particular, the nature of its insurance contract. If an institution is going to be liquidated, essentially what the federal government, through the FDIC, does is it pays off the insured depositors. It essentially writes them a check for the amount of their deposit and accrued interest, up to $100,000 per depositor. And at that point, the insured depositors are no longer involved in the transaction. They receive their money. Presumably, they take it and deposit it in another bank or another financial intermediary, and they're out of the picture. The FDIC, in exchange for paying off the depositors, is subrogated to their rights. It takes over their rights. It steps into their shoes with respect to the institution. And it is therefore entitled to get from the institution what the depositors would have gotten in the absence of a federal deposit insurance scheme. So this is actually a complicated aspect of our regulatory structure. There are two separate things going on. One is the insurance contract between the federal government and the depositors, which is a contractual statutory arrangement. And the second thing is the operation of the corporate law of banks, which has a rule for the distribution of assets to creditors in the event of failure. And the general rule in the United States is that depositors, all depositors, whether insured or uninsured, have priority with respect to the assets of the bank. So in the institution we're looking at, there's roughly $50 million of available assets. The loan to the federal government has been repaid, so there's only $37 million worth of loans here. And if you add up all the assets, there are $50 million worth of assets, presumably the value they can be sold on the market for. And that has to be shared amongst all of the creditors with seniority. That is, it has to be shared amongst all of the depositors, both the insured, or the FDIC is subrogee for the insured depositors, and the uninsured depositors. So one of the peculiar characteristics of American banking law is that while the insured depositors have insurance, they don't have any special right vis-a-vis other depositors with respect to the assets of their institution. So the FDIC pays off the insured depositors, steps into their feet, and shares in the proceeds of the liquidation. We now are in the position where we can figure out what the liquidation strategy will cost the federal government. As I've mentioned, there are available in the disposition $50 million worth of assets. The total liabilities laying claim to these assets is $61.2 million. That's the amount of the deposits. And there is an implicit loss here of $11.2 million, the difference between the two. Now, just as an aside, in case you're interested, this loss is 18% of the value of the deposits. So essentially, there's going to be a loss of 18.3% on the deposits. And that is not an unusual rate of loss on an institution that fails. Usually, in the United States, when a bank becomes failed, it will have a loss of somewhere between 5 and 20%. The smaller the institution, the larger the number, typically. Large institutions, when they fail, typically have losses that are a bit smaller because they're better diversified, presumably, and other aspects of their business make the losses likely smaller. But this is sort of a typical loss ratio. There are occasionally, say, once or twice in 100 bank failures, massive fraud involved in the United States where you'll see higher loss levels, but this is sort of a typical example of a failure in the United States. So the question is, who will bear the loss? Well, if you look at the relative amounts of insured depositors and uninsured depositors, what you see, if you do the math, is that the insured depositors constitute 80% of the deposits here. Uninsured are roughly 20%. So the assets are divided up in precisely that way. 80% of the assets, or $40 million, are given to the FDIC as subrogee of the insured depositors. The remaining $10 million of assets are returned to the uninsured depositors. You can now, at this point, figure out what the losses are to the individual groups. I said earlier that the total loss implicit here is $11.2 million, and if you look at the difference between the claims of the insured depositors and what they receive, their claims are $49 million, they receive $40 million, so the loss to the FDIC is $9 million. The loss to the uninsured depositors is $2.2 million. For purposes of our discussion, though, the number you want to pay attention to is the cost to the FDIC. By liquidating the institution, paying off the insured depositors $49 million, recovering from the institution $40 million, the FDIC, federal government, loses $9 million on this transaction. Now, presumably, it has reserves to handle this amount of funds. In the United States, all depository institutions pay an annual fee to the FDIC insurance funds in order to maintain appropriate reserves. The fee has gone up and gone down depending on the financial situation in the United States. Currently, in the United States, the fee is quite low, but occasionally it's been as high as almost 25 basis points per year, which is relatively high. But the fee creates this reserve, which is presumably adequate to cover the cost of $9 million in this particular situation. So one thing that the FDIC could do is liquidate the institution and incur a loss of $9 million. That's sort of a baseline situation. Are there other alternatives that it might be able to pursue that would lower the cost to the federal government of the transaction? Well, the answer is there usually are. There often are. And typically in the United States, these other transactions are structured as what we call purchase and assumption transactions. And you see several possibilities suggested in the problem here involving the Palatka National Bank. Now, as the problem describes, and again, I'd encourage you to take a look at it, there are often institutions that are interested in acquiring failed banks. The Palatka National Bank is a bank from a nearby market that's interested in expanding into the area where this failed bank is located. And it sees presumably some economic value of expanding its operations into this particular region. It could enter by itself with a new branch, presumably, or some other direct expansion strategy. But it might be preferable to acquire an existing institution, even one in financial difficulty, in order to take over the existing customer relationships, to take over the goodwill that's involved in this institution, to make itself an instant presence in the market. And essentially what we're seeing in these alternative strategies is an institution that's willing to pay certain amounts of funds to acquire the insolvent institution. Now, when I say pay for an insolvent institution, that's kind of a technical term in the United States, and let me just show you how the transactions are structured so you can compare them in terms of policy and also in terms of cost to the federal government with the liquidation strategy we've already discussed. So let's begin with the first proposed transaction. In this initial transaction, we have to discuss what the terms are. The acquirer, the Palatka Bank, is willing to assume all of the deposits, or is proposing to take over all of the deposits of the failed bank. So there were $61.2 million worth of deposits, which it's willing to take over. It is going to, once it makes this transaction, get a loan for $20 million from the FDIC, which is at a preferred rate. And the value of this loan is put at $3 million, which you could think of this as a cost to the FDIC. If the FDIC agrees to make this loan, it's essentially giving $3 million of value to Palatka. So it's a cost to the FDIC, as we'll see. In return for all this, Palatka is willing to pay the FDIC, pay back $10 million. And the way that we usually conceive of this in the United States is Palatka is willing to put $10 million into this failed institution to help recapitalize it. So you can think of, and this is an accurate way of looking at the problem, this institution as having $50 million of its own assets plus a $10 million payment from the Palatka Bank for a total of $60 million of assets. Now, it has also $61.2 million worth of deposits. And the deposits now are still a little bit greater than the assets. In fact, the difference is $1.2 million. And the assumption of these transactions is the FDIC will put in, the federal government will put in the additional amount of money necessary to bring the deposits and the assets into balance. So because there is still a shortfall of $1.2 million, the FDIC has to put in this additional amount of value. And that's the complete transaction. The purchaser takes over all the deposits. There is value of $3 million added. There's a payment of $10 million by the purchaser, and the FDIC covers the shortfall. If you add all of these things together in terms of cost for the FDIC, it has essentially two costs, $1.2 million for covering the difference between the assets and liabilities, and the $3 million cost of loan. What that makes in terms of a total cost to the FDIC is $4.2 million. That's the total cost to the FDIC of proceeding in this way. If you compare that with the liquidation alternative, what we see has happened is the FDIC has essentially saved itself almost $5 million. It saved itself $5 million basically by finding someone that's willing to pay for the institution's goodwill and business contacts. And Palatka is willing to pay $10 million. It's asking for a loan of $3 million, so the net payment is in some sense $7 million, but it's willing to pay a big chunk of money in order to take over this institution. And as a result of auctioning off the goodwill and business operations of the failed institution, the FDIC has substantially reduced its operating budget for this failure to the tune of roughly $5 million in savings. And because of this savings, for many years, this was the disposition strategy of choice in the United States. Throughout the 1980s, the vast majority of failed banks were disposed of, not through liquidation, but through purchase and assumption transactions whereby outside buyers were encouraged to bid for failed institutions and make a payment for those institutions. Often there would be multiple bidders, and the institution that made the highest bid for the purchase and assumption transaction would be allowed to purchase the institution, assuming the other regulatory approvals could be obtained, assuming the acquiring institution had the management and other capabilities to engage in the transaction, and also, critically in the United States, assuming that there weren't any anti-competitive problems from the proposed transaction, that it didn't create some sort of monopoly in the marketplace. So this was a disposition strategy of choice, and it has the obvious value of reducing the cost to the federal government. Now, although the purchase and assumption transactions I've just described were the kind of strategies used most frequently in the 1980s, and they had the desirable effect of reducing the cost to the federal government as compared with a liquidation approach, they were controversial in certain respects and subject to a number of criticisms in policy circles. And I think it's important to understand the nature of those criticisms. And they come from the way in which the transactions were structured. In particular, the fact that in typical traditional purchase and assumption transactions, all of the deposits of the institution were assumed by the acquirer. the acquirer specifically wanted to have a depository institution that was whole, that whose operations were not disrupted, and therefore insisted that not just insured depositors, but uninsured depositors also be assumed in these transactions. This is particularly important if you are acquiring an insolvent bank with the hopes of taking over its commercial banking relationships. Those banking relationships would often entail deposits of greater than $100,000, that is, uninsured deposits. And what you would want to make sure of is those customers did not leave the institution or become dissatisfied with its operations. So it was often critical in the structuring of these transactions that the uninsured depositors be included and be covered in full in the transactions. So that was a perspective of the acquirers. They're willing to pay sums like $10 million in order to get those complete institutions in the transaction. But for many in the field of supervision, this was a troubling practice, because what it said was that not only were the insured depositors protected in the event of failure, but so too were the uninsured depositors. No matter what happened to the institution, all depositors were essentially paid 100 cents on the dollar after the bank was disposed of. And many people criticized this because it created what's known as a moral hazard problem. It created a problem that there was no incentive to monitor the institutions on the part of depositors, because whatever happened, they would in all likelihood be bailed out. So there was increased pressure on the government to develop disposition strategies that forced depositors that were not insured to incur some losses. And some of the next strategies we look at, in fact, the next one we look at, will reflect this alternative kind of arrangement. By way of an analogy here, those of you who have been following the international financial crisis lately have seen precisely the same issues arising in a number of countries in Asia. There have been bailout strategies that have essentially ensured foreign creditors complete repayment of their loans in order to maintain stability, to maintain the flow of credit. But the criticism of these strategies in some circles has been it creates a moral hazard, it creates a disincentive to monitor carefully the situation of various sovereign countries, and there is an argument afoot in the international community that banks in this sovereign lending or international lending should face some economic losses when there is, in essence, an insolvency on the part of economic borrowers within countries or sovereign borrowers themselves. So this kind of an argument is played out at different levels, and the results differ from context to context. But it's a familiar one in the United States, at least, with respect to the failure of depository institutions. The second proposed transaction by Palatka, in essence, is one that conforms to the requirement that only insured depositors be assumed in the transaction. So you can imagine Palatka saying, we'll buy the bank under certain circumstances if we take over all the deposits. However, if we're only going to take over the insured deposits, the nature of the transaction we're proposing to undertake here will be a little bit different. And that's precisely what this problem does. The purchaser would assume only insured deposits in this second case. It still wants to get the loan, which has a value of $3 million. But the big difference is it only pays $9 million. For the transaction this way. So it reduces its payment by $1 million, and that changes in various ways the economics of the transaction. To work through the economics, if you look at the figure here, the institution will be assuming $49 million worth of deposits. It will get from the liquidation, from the failed bank, $40 million worth of assets. That's down from $50 million because $10 million worth of the assets are set aside for the uninsured depositors. They're going to get what they were entitled to in liquidation, which is $10 million or roughly 82% of their deposits. So that $10 million is pulled away. $40 million remains available for the insured depositors. On top of that, we add the $9 million that the Palatka acquirer is willing to pay. And the FDIC technically has the obligation to cover, but in this situation, because 40 and 9 equals 49, there is the same number of assets as there are liabilities here, the accounts are in balance. And you can now figure out what the cost of this transaction is to the FDIC. It is, in essence, $3 million, because the only cost really is the subsidized loan it has to provide the purchaser. It doesn't have to put any funds in to match the liabilities. So this approach is less expensive than the approach of the full purchase and assumption transaction. If you compare the two approaches, what's going on is we've reduced the cost of the disposition strategy from $4.2 million when Palatka takes over all the deposits to $3 million when we do what's known as a modified payout or the assumption of only insured deposits. Now, if you go back and look at these figures again, you could probably figure out why the costs have gone down. It's a little bit counterintuitive because on the one hand, the Palatka Bank is willing to pay less. It's only paying $9 million as opposed to $10 million. So that would seem to increase the cost to the federal government because it's receiving a slightly smaller payment. But what you have to remember is in the earlier transaction with the full assumption, the uninsured depositors were getting $2.2 million worth of extra value. They were getting the full amount of their uninsured deposits of $12.2 million. Under the revised strategy, they get $2.2 million less. They only get $10 million rather than $12.2 million. So in essence, $2.2 million of value has been taken away from them. The FDIC gets $1 million less in compensation from Palatka, but that still makes it $1.2 million better off, which is precisely the difference between its costs in these two strategies. The low-cost strategy in this situation is the uninsured is the insured deposit payoff strategy where the FDIC only has to pay $3 million. Now, in the United States, as we'll see a little later on, what the FDIC is now required to do when it has a bank to be disposed of is it's got to pick the strategy that has the lowest costs to the institution, to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So in this situation, it wouldn't pick liquidation because that has a $9 million cost. It wouldn't pick a purchase and assumption transaction with a complete deposit transfer because that costs 4.2, and the modified structure allows for a $3 million transaction, which is the one that we've just been looking at. In the 1980s, the FDIC didn't have to make this least cost calculation. All that it had to do was try to find a strategy that was cheaper than liquidation, and so it could choose either of these strategies of full assumption or partial assumption. And as I mentioned, it tended to choose the full assumption strategies because that's the one that the local economies usually favored, it had the least disruption to local business, and the FDIC often went along, even though it wasn't necessarily the cheapest approach for the federal government. At the risk of complicating an already complicated subject, let me just throw out an alternative question for you. And this involves the modified assumption strategy we've been just discussing. We assumed in the problem that the Palatka was willing to pay $9 million to take over the institution in a modified payout strategy. But what if it didn't? If it wasn't willing to pay out $9 million? Let's say, and I've revised the slide here to show a slightly different set of numbers, what if it only was willing to pay out $5 million? So if the disruption to the business of this activity were sufficiently great that it only was willing to pay $5 million, what would that mean for our consideration here? Well, you could do the math, and what you would find if you did the math here is that the FDIC would now have to put in some additional money to make this transaction work, because the $5 million payment would not be enough to make the assets of the institution match its liabilities. The FDIC would have to put in an extra $4 million of covering, and the cost of cover would then have to be added to the total cost of the loan, making a total cost to the FDIC of this transaction $7 million. In comparison to the prior strategies we looked at, that means that the modified payout would now cost more than the purchase and assumption transaction. In fact, it would cost $7 million to the FDIC as opposed to $4.2 million. Under these circumstances, which is the preferred strategy for the FDIC, do you think? Should the government accept the modified payout with a $7 million cost, or should it accept a purchase and assumption transaction which has a lower $4.2 million cost? Those of you who are interested, I throw that out to you. Feel free to post a reaction to it on the discussion groups, and I will be happy to respond to your suggestions. The final strategy that's considered in the exercise, I don't want to deal with in too great detail. It's common in the United States, and I'm not sure how relevant this is to the situation in the People's Republic of China right now, but let me just throw it out. Oftentimes in the United States, we are concerned about the competitive structure of the banking industry, and we become concerned in the United States with banks receiving too large a market share, particularly as a result of taking over insolvent institutions. If the FDIC or the other federal banking agencies were of the view that that was going on in this case, it might reject the Palatka proposal, even though they had relatively low costs, and consider a local bid by institutions such as the Fishkill Savings Bank that have less financial resources and less capability of paying to take over the insolvent bank. In this situation, the Fishkill group was willing to pay $2 million to take over the institution. And it's proposing essentially the same transaction as Palatka was proposing, except Palatka was proposing to pay $10 million. So, in effect, by putting in $8 million less dollars, Fishkill would essentially cost the government $8 million more for the disposition. In other words, $12.2 million. So, in essence, the Fishkill proposal is not that attractive. It doesn't really improve the government's situation, even in comparison to liquidation. It's a relatively expensive strategy. And you might ask yourself, should the government ever choose this approach? And, that's an interesting question of policy. It's certainly not financially advantageous in the short term. It might be advantageous from certain perspectives, if it creates competition in the banking markets, although one wonders whether it's viable competition, given the relatively low amount that Fishkill is willing to pay, it might have some advantages for the local economy in terms of keeping the financial institution in place. But again, that may be a speculative benefit, and one that at least many analysts would be concerned of crediting in a serious way, since the costs are immediate and real, and the benefits are to some degree speculative. However, the question that's posed here is one that I think is an important one, and I would put it generally in the following context. Are there circumstances in which the government, a government, should choose to undertake a disposition strategy for a failed depository institution that is more expensive than other alternatives? The other alternatives being simply liquidation or selling to a ready buyer such as the Palatka Bank that is willing to contribute value and thereby reduce the government's cost. So in the context of the problem we've been looking at, should the government ever be willing to pay more than the $3 or $4 million it would have to pay if Palatka took over? Should it ever be willing to pay more than the $9 million of liquidation, in this case, if there were no ready buyers? That's, I think, an important question, and let me just sort of briefly outline the way we think about that issue in the United States. Well, I think that there are three possible justifications for such an action. And one possibility, which I think is related to the problem that I've posed to you for the discussion group, is under certain circumstances, the government might forego the least costly strategy in order to prevent a moral hazard problem in the future. In other words, there may be some instances in which the government would be willing to pay a little bit more money itself because it wanted to ensure that some costs were imposed on uninsured depositors and other creditors to keep this group mindful of monitoring in the future. The reason that this would cost the government more is in some circumstances it would eliminate goodwill of an institution and thereby make it less attractive for disposition in the regular market. So that might be one consideration, a trade-off between cost to the federal government and creating appropriate incentives in the future. Another possibility, which we've already alluded to in the problem, in particular the Fishkill case, is there might be considerations of anti-competitive policy for rejecting an acquisition by the highest bidder if you wanted to maintain another competitor in the marketplace. As I mentioned, there is some skepticism about doing this. It entails the government kind of second-guessing the marketplace, making a view that the market structure should include another competitor even when a private party has not stepped up and proposed to do that in an effective way. However, oftentimes governments are tempted to take such action. It's possible to justify that on the basis of various kinds of market failures. Although it's also a risky strategy because the government could, in some sense, get it wrong and be just protecting vested interests as opposed to actual competitive dynamics within the marketplace. But a possible justification is anti-competitive concerns in terms of structuring an appropriate market. Conceptually, I think the most important consideration, though, is intervention to spend additional funds for systemic concerns, particularly that would arise in the event of liquidation of an institution. if liquidation is the cheapest way of going, if there are no bidders, if the problem, if the institution is in such difficulties that private parties are not coming forward, and there is going to be a liquidation, there is often the fear in financial markets that this will have systemic consequences, that will have systemic consequences either in terms of economic dislocations within the region from closure, or that there could be actually a spread of failures from one institution to another. And in order to prevent these consequences, the government is often urged to contribute funds to make a bailout viable, in some instances even to allow past management to stay on with the use of financial resources. This is by far the most controversial and problematic justification for more expensive disposition strategies. It's controversial because it lends itself to special interest group pleadings and abuse, but it's also controversial because if the government were to get this wrong and to inappropriately liquidate an institution, there could be profound economic consequences, which should be avoided if possible, and which put fear in the hearts of regulators and make them, if anything, more prone to intervene on this account than would likely be appropriate. But it's a high-stakes area of regulatory policy and one that is of considerable importance. At this stage, I think, since the hour is running out, or actually has more than run out, I think, at this point, what I would like to do is simply point you to a few provisions of the regulatory structure in the United States that implement some of the ideas we've been discussing today, just so you see how they are reduced to statutory language. The concept that I've already mentioned several times of least cost resolution is discussed in the casebook, and it's embodied in Section 1823C of Title 12, which is in the statutory supplement. If you read this through, what you will see is essentially the FDIC is called upon to pick the least costly disposition strategy. This is essentially to encourage the FDIC to select strategies that impose losses on uninsured depositors, or in any event, to pick the least costly disposition strategy for the federal government. This is a provision that encourages fiscal prudence, preservation of government resources, and also is supposed to encourage market. The notion that there might be an exception to least cost resolution in the case of systemic risk is embraced a little further on in the same provision. What you'll see here is the federal government does have the authority to spend more than the least cost rules require if it's necessary to prevent serious adverse effects on the economy or financial structure of the United States. However, in order to invoke this authority, what the provision requires is that numerous regulatory bodies have to sign off, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, the Board of Governors of the FDIC, and also the Secretary of the Treasury after consulting with the President. This is, in the United States at least, a highly unusual provision. Supermajority rules for some of the votes, but a collective decision-making process has to take place before this authority can be instigated. And as a result, it is very unusual to be used. I think since it was adopted in the early 1990s, it has not been invoked in the United States, but it does at least create the latitude for bailouts of financial institutions that are not cost effective on their simple terms. Interestingly, in terms of fiscal responsibility, there's another provision yet further in this section about who will pay for the costs of this extra funding. And the answer is basically there is required to be a special assessment on the banking industry to cover the costs of systemic protections, the theory being that if they were not allowed, the losses would be imposed on the financial industry through systemic problems, and therefore the financial services industry is the appropriate group within our economy to shoulder the costs here. So this is an after-the-fact risk-spreading provision that is interesting and, as I mentioned before, has not yet been invoked, but the structure is in place to defray the cost of systemic failure prevention. I see that we are now at the end of the hour, and I still have not had a chance to discuss a few other issues about bank failure strategies. What I think I'd like to do is in the next class, class 10, discuss those relatively quickly. And then we will take a short break from our plodding through the casebook materials. I have just finished a paper on financial regulatory competition in international markets, and it's quite relevant to the topics we're discussing in this lecture series, and I thought it might be a nice change of pace to take a look at that. So we will do a little bit of cleanup next week on insolvent and troubled banks, and then move on to the other paper that I have presented that I think some of you may find of interest. But thank you very much for your attention in today's class. I apologize again for the delay in posting this lecture. I hope it hasn't inconvenienced members of the class. And I would invite any of you who have comments about the disposition strategies I've discussed today to post them on the discussion group associated with today's lectures. So thank you very much, and I look forward to seeing you again next week.